This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
I don't know if you've ever built anything from scratch. I'm not necessarily one of those handy people. But our church is made up of some incredible people who can bring lots of pieces together to make something special. We have people who can work with wood and build pieces of craftsmanship that can be passed down from one generation to another. Or you might be able to build houses, or you might just be able to keep with the upkeep of your house without having to pay for someone to do that. That's a pretty amazing thing. Others have recipes that they've received from previous generations. These recipes grab different pieces and fuse them together over a specific time frame at specific temperatures to produce amazingly delectable things. That's what's going on in that process. And so wherever you're at on that spectrum, there's probably something that you're able to do from scratch. Maybe you take just notes on a page and you're able to make something of that. And all of these are pictures or illustrations of a view of life. Our lives are made up of many different pieces that come together in time with differing levels of heat to create who we are. That's how God's made you who you are. There's pieces of you that have come together, different pieces of life that have come together for you over time. And it's made you who you are. And this is why the purpose or the end game of life is so significant. Why are all these pieces and things being pulled together to make who you are? Why bother with that? Why consider these different pieces? Or why bother with this time element? Or why give attention to different aspects of life? Well, one response might be to say, well, all is vanity. You know, it's just chasing after the wind. Who can know these things? But part of what we're seeing here in our study of Ecclesiastes is that there's a master builder behind these things. There's someone who's putting together all these things in your life so that to make you who you are, to put you together. He's putting together pieces. He's putting together time. He's even putting together different levels of stress in your life to make you who you are. And so today we're going to dig into some of those elements, and specifically two of them, time and then other aspects of life. So our focus for the study of Ecclesiastes is there in this logo we have and in this statement, the joy of fearing God under the sun. So you might have a lot of thoughts about what the book of Ecclesiastes is about. You might already see some of those themes, but the joy of fearing God under the sun, this is where we're headed. There's a life or there's a way of living that we're putting together under the sun in the sense of not above the sun in the heavens, but here on earth, under the sun, as we live life here. And in these opening chapters, these first two chapters that we've looked at in the book of Ecclesiastes, we've seen that much of the gain or profit from our toil is just vanity. It's a chasing after the wind. Last week, specifically, we saw that seeking wisdom doesn't ever satisfy. There's always more to know. There's always more to put into practice. Or pursuing pleasure is fleeting. It doesn't matter what you could go after, what kind of things you could put into your life that would give you enjoyment. It's just a short-lived thrill. It's fleeting. And even toil, all the work that you've been given to do in life, without a view of God, is going to be empty at the end of the day. So it's vanity. It's failing to achieve the purpose it was meant for. And then last time we saw this refrain over and over again. It's a chasing after the wind. It's a never-ending thirst for more, and it's never completed. That's kind of what life is. You've heard of it called a rat race, and it's just kind of a striving after the wind. It's a chasing after the wind. And so today we turn our attention to chapters 3 and 4, and we go a little further down the road to seeing where our author wants us to go. So the writer of Ecclesiastes doesn't come right out of the gate and say, well, here's the deal. I want you to enjoy life, and I want you to fear God in this life you've been given under the sun. No, he has to take us to the end of ourselves and all these other aspects of life so that we can pursue God and the things that matter most. At the end, in chapter 12, all the evidence is going to be seen. Therefore, fear God and keep his commandments. That's where our author wants us to go. That's where Solomon's directing us. So today, specifically in chapters 3 and 4, we're going to see a call to joy again in God's gifts, as well as we're going to see some insight for what is God up to? What's his aim for all of his actions in the world? And the aim of that, we're going to be told, is that people would fear him, that they would fear before him. This is going to help us see what life was meant for. So these pieces, time and heat and all the stuff that God is accomplishing in our lives is moving us somewhere. So we're going to continue to see themes of vanity under the sun, striving after the wind. We're going to be asked again the question that we've been wrestling with for two chapters. What is the profit of toil? So we're going to be given insight to time. And in chapter four, we're going to be talking about all kinds of different ways that we can pursue a better life. And so I hope you engage with these two chapters to get wisdom from God for time and life. That's where we're headed. So this morning, by way of introduction again, have you ever considered why you are made up the way you are? Why you're wired the way you are? Or even maybe even why you're here this morning? How did that happen? Why did that happen? What about your life? Why is it put together the way it is? Why maybe are you married to someone who's way more picky about the details of life than you are? Or maybe, you know, you have to work with people that are more organized or see the world differently than you do, or maybe they're not as organized as you are, and that leads to frustration. What's up with all this? Why are you alive in this moment with these people around you, with the challenges that you're facing? What has God up to in all this? You ever wonder about those questions? Well, today's sermon is not going to give you all the answers. So that's one thing I want to say. But I think there are some broad trajectories. There are some broad ways of seeing the world and seeing what God's up to, that he's not just left us spinning so that we can react accordingly or that he can react accordingly. Like, God hasn't set the world in motion and just kind of like, well, I've done all I can and here, and I'm just, my hands are tied. I don't know what to do. No, God's actively engaged in creation. So one thing we're going to see here, especially in chapter 3, that God's up to working in time. He's somehow above time, and yet he's working in the midst of time to do something, to accomplish something in our lives. In fact, we know this is true because of the gospel, right? Jesus actually came into the midst of our world. He actually lived a real life. He was actually a person on earth. He came to earth and he got dirty with sufferings and trials of this world. Last week in Crestview Kids, we had this story where Jesus takes, you know, his outer garment, wraps it around his waist and scrubbing dirt off people's feet. You know, this is kind of how God acted in the flesh. And people hated it. They just put him to death. They weren't interested in that. This was all part of God's bigger plan, though. And today, I'm hoping you can see how God's at work in the time and the times and moments of your life so that you might relate to him. That's what he's after. He's at work in the time and in the moments of your life so that you can have a relationship with him. He's not just doing this that's curious. I wonder what this is about. No, he's doing it for the purpose of relationship. And if you are related to him, we need these reminders about the times that we live in. We need reminders about wisdom that we're called to walk in. We need to be reminded that there's a time for everything under heaven. And God has so worked in time that his eternal plans are meant to be pursued. So there's some core realities of life under the sun that we need to walk in. And that's what we're going to see in these two chapters. So I hope you'll join me today as we see two aspects of life under the sun that God fills with wisdom. Two aspects of life under the sun that God fills with wisdom. And to get there, let's read this poem and question that begin chapter 3. So, Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 through 9. Follow along with me as I read that. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up what's planted. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to break down, and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? So this is God's word. Thanks be to God. So we're going to begin digging into chapter 3 here, seeing two aspects of life under the sun that God fills with wisdom. And first of all, as we begin in chapter 3 helps us see that one aspect of life under the sun is that God orders time that we may have joy in fearing him. God orders time that we may have joy in fearing him. Time. You can probably recognize that from the passage I just read, right? That time is the large theme of this passage. So in case you didn't catch it there, there was a lot about time in verses 1 through 8. And that opening question of chapter 1, or the opening explanation in verse 1, sorry. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. This is the big idea. Back when the book began in chapter 1, we began with this question of what gain does the worker have from his toil, and that was followed by a poem that talked about life. And it seemed to end real, almost negatively. And now the writer's a lot more optimistic. This poem seems to build to that. So we have this poem on time in verses 1 through 8. And it's an amazing poem. It's been the subject of songs, so I know a lot of you are just anxious for me to bust out into the birds and for everything, turn, 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 there's a season and a time for every purpose under heaven. So it's a song, but it's a poem. It's that is meant to move us. The author uses the word time 28 times over 14 lines of poetry. And Solomon's wanting us to see that every time or season is envisioned. So that's the purpose of poetry. It's drawing us out. It's giving us language that there's a time for every season and a time for every matter under heaven. That's what's going on. Each line cancels out each other, right? So a time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up. All these cancel each other. A time to seek in verse 6. So in other words, a time to seek something you've lost. There's a time for that. And there's a time to give up the search and just actually lose it. That's what verse 6 is. It's kind of a confusing thing. It's not a time to seek and a time to lose. So there's a time to look for something you've lost, and then a time to just say, well, can't find it, done with that. Time to keep, time to cast away, time to tear, time to sow, time to be silent, a time to speak, time to love, a time to hate, war and peace. A time for everything. That's what the poem's seeking to show us. But without missing a beat, our writer isn't interested in just leaving us with this glowing, like, oh yeah, there is a time for everything under heaven. He's made the point, and he goes right in, beginning in verse 9, with an explanation of that poem. So let me read down to verse 15. What gain has the worker from his toil? I've seen the business that God has given the children of man to be busy with. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he's put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all of his toil. This is God's gift to man. And I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor can anything be taken away from it. God's done it so that people may fear before him. That which is already has been. And that which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. So we're given an explanation here. And it begins with that question again. What gain has the worker from his toil? We in a sense, want to say to Solomon, chill out, man. That's the third time you've asked this question in this book. We get it. It's vanity. Right? That's almost what we want to say to him. But what he follows with is not an explanation of vanity. He follows with an explanation of God. Lots of thoughts about God. That God has given a lot of things for men to be busy with. So the idea isn't that now work all of a sudden has profit in and of itself. No, we're drawn to see that God's up to something in time. That God's accomplishing something in giving us toil. And we already know this because we read the end of chapter 2, but he's back to that same theme. He's made everything beautiful in its time. That under God's hand, work isn't merely vanity, but God's wired the lives of humans with eternity on their hearts. They're unable to find out what God's done from beginning to end. He's strangely worked in the ordering of human life in a way that's incomprehensible to us. We don't get it, but he's at work in the midst of that. So we might throw up and say, well, okay, God, I can't figure this out. What am I supposed to do? Well, he tells us. How do we live? Well, verses 12 and 13 tell us how we live. We're called to be joyful. We're called to do good. We're called to eat and drink and take pleasure in our toil. Why? Because that's just the right thing to do? No. We take pleasure and do all these things and enjoy life, and we do good because it's a gift from God, because he's given it to us. God's done his thing, and his work has staying power. It endures forever. In fact, we can't even add or take away from it. What God's intended to do, he's somehow sovereign over all of his creation, and yet he's working in the midst of our lives that we live, and it's meaningful. There's nothing new under the sun. That which has already been, that which is to be, has already been done. God seeks what's been driven away. So what we pursue and we can't hold on to, God's there giving meaning to. God's holding on to these things. He's going after them. He's ordering our lives in time. And he's doing this so that we have joy in fearing him under the sun. I mean, we have a great statement of the purpose of this book right there in the middle of chapter 3. That's what he's up to in time. That's what he's up to in the minutia of your life. He's saying, I got a time for everything. And you don't always see the things that I'm up to in your life. But all the things that I am up to, which endure forever, I'm up to so that you would have joy in them. Because those are my gifts to you. This is what he's calling us to. And in the end game is, I'm doing this so that you would fear me. So you'd be related to me rightly. So we get a warning then at the end of chapter 3. There's a warning about, like, getting all dreamy, I think. Because in light of that, we might think, oh yeah, that's going to be really good someday when I get there. And we're kind of getting this dreamy, like, oh really, God? Me and you forever? Wow, this is going to be terrific. And so the writer of Solomon wants to jolt us back into the reality of living under the sun. So he gives us a warning here in verses 16 through the end of the chapter. Here's what we read there. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. And I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. I said in my heart with regard to the children of man that God is testing them, that they may see that they are themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beast is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beast, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward to Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So I saw there's nothing better than a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? Are you blessed by that reading? what is he talking about? Well, verse 16, let's go back and just plod through it, right? Verse 16, there's all kinds of injustice that we see in this world, right? And in verse 17, God, there's a promise here that God's going to judge that. That's part of time, right? There's a time for everything under heaven, and there's also a time where God's going to right all the wrongs of this world. Injustice won't have the final word. God's justice will have the final word. This is part of time. But he gets into this idea of we might pride ourselves that we're better than the beasts. But in reality, all that injustice that he just talked about is showing that we're just savages like the beasts. That's what he's saying. You know, we're really no better than them. And in reality, whether man or beast, we're all going to die. We all have breath, whether man or beast, and this is a vanity. We're from dust, and we're headed back to dust. So you might object to the claims of verses 18 through 20, and Solomon continues by reminding you in verse 21 that when we consider death solely by itself, we're just like the beasts. So you might think, all dogs don't go to heaven. That's not his point. Solomon's point is that just like animals die, you're going to die. You're going back to the dirt. You know, God formed you out of that, and God's going to send you back there. So the whole point, I think, what he's getting at in this whole thinking about time and being under the sun is, don't get too caught up in thinking about someday kind of living, right? We all drift into that. Someday I'm going to get around to really enjoying this. Someday I'll really consider enjoying what God's given me. And what Solomon's saying is, no, that time is right now. God's given you that right now. Death is coming. So for you to say, well, God's given me all these gifts. Yeah, I know I need to enjoy life, but you don't understand the stress I'm under. Solomon's saying, wait, you're just like a beast. It's crazy. You're going to die. Death is coming. So you can't determine to get around to enjoying life someday. That is your calling now, in the here and now. Joy is your calling. So God orders time that we may have joy in fearing Him. That's what He's saying. That there's not some day coming when you're going to get around to this. If you're not enjoying life and enjoying the gifts that God's given you now, you can't have confidence under the sun that that's going to happen someday. So it's kind of a morbid outlook, you know, like, well, thanks for the good news. No, but he's just simply compelling you, live today. God is calling you to have joy in fearing Him right now. Don't put that off to another day and say, well, I'm going to live forever. Well, of course you are if you're a believer. You're going to live forever. That's not His point. He's not getting into the whole thing about the afterlife here. He's saying that God's put, even in saying that God's put eternity on our hearts, He's saying that there's elements of time that are incomprehensible for us, but God's doing all this so that we can have joy in fearing Him. That we can take advantage of all the good things He's done for us now under the sun, that we would actually step into enjoying those in the moment. So, that's chapter 3. There's a time for everything, and it is high time, and now is the time for you to take joy in the things that God's given you out of a fear for Him, out of a reverence for Him, out of a relationship with Him. That's what he's driving at in chapter 3. Well, secondly and finally, he turns the corner into chapter 4. We have 16 verses there, and there's another aspect that he shows of living under the life under the sun, that God offers wisdom through a better way of living life. That's the best way I could summarize it. There seems to be like four movements. If you read through chapter 4 and you have your highlighter in your hand or you have a pen you can mark and you're okay marking in your Bible, just start circling all the times in chapter 4 that this phrase better shows up. That's what he's showing. He's showing that there's a better way to live life than what we're doing now. He's kind of bringing that raw joy of fearing God wisdom. What does it look like boots on the ground? What does it look like to live a certain way? And he's saying there's a better way to live than maybe what you're currently experiencing. So that's what we need to be curious about. We have this vision for what God's up to in our lives related to time, that he's ordered all time so that we could have joy in fearing him under the sun. And now there's wisdom for a better way of life. There's some spheres of life that we need to consider what the way of wisdom would look like. For instance, in verses 1 through 3, we see that we need a better way of living as we face oppression. So look at verses 1 to 3. Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better, there's better again, better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. So, a better way of living as we face oppression. You might think, well, there's no way I can not be. I'm here. What is he saying? Well, there's all kinds of people in our world who are oppressed. So, I think a lot of times we just try to explain that away. We don't know what to do with that. We see oppression and we maybe explain it away. We say, people, well, that's not really a valid experience. You're making that up. Or we try to explain it away. And Solomon's point is to point out that it does exist, and often it isn't met with comfort. Those who are oppressed are not often met with comfort. The oppressors seem to have all the power, and no one is comforting the oppressed. That's what he says twice in those two verses, right? There's no comfort. There's no comfort. And in light of that, it seems like death would be preferable to life. So, well, I guess it'd just be better if I was dead and wouldn't have to experience this. But there's something better. And he's saying it's better just to be unborn and not see all this evil. So what's he driving at? How is this a way to live? Well, what he's saying is that as you live life, you're going to be met with experiences, and there's a reality of death coming, and you need to be living with that kind of tenderness as if you're experiencing this new. You need to live with a kind of tenderness for comfort. And I think back to the end of chapter 3, kind of fusing this all together, we should take time to enjoy God's gifts, especially our toil. In light of oppression, all the more reason that we should enjoy God's gifts in the present. We can't say, well, because this oppression exists in the world, therefore I can't enjoy this. You know, we try to do that sometimes, right? Like, with all this oppression in the world, there's no way that I can enjoy this. And he's saying, no, it's not an excuse. It doesn't excuse you. You know, it's not like death would be preferable. It would be better if you just had never had any experience with that at all. So therefore, enjoy. Step into the calling that God's given you under the sun. Enjoy his gifts as you face oppression, as we live in the reality of oppression. Another scenario is in verses 4 through 7. 4 through 7. I guess 4 through 8. Is when there's a better way of living needed when envy is lurking. So look at verse 4. Then I saw all toil and all skill and work come from man's envy of his neighbor. This is a vanity and the striving after the wind. The fool folds his hand and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after the wind. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil. And his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is a vanity and an unhappy business. So when envy is lurking, there's craziness. That's what he's saying here. There's a craziness that there's all kinds of skillful work being done just so that we can keep up with the people next to us. Just so that we can keep getting more and more and keep up with the Joneses. But we all know a Joneses that is more needy than we are. So I hesitate to use that illustration. Like Vivek and his family. Whenever I put that in there, I was like, oh, I'm not trying to keep up with the Joneses at all. They're way more needy than I am. But his point is like envy. We look at what our neighbor has and we think, well, I got to work hard and, you know, I need to exhaust myself and get every bit of assets and money that I can so I can keep up with them. There's all kinds of skillful work being done with that. And envy is lurking about and driving our hard work. But this is a vanity. It's a striving after the wind. It's not fulfilling the purpose it was intended for. If you're out busting your hide to keep up with people like that, it's vanity. That's not the purpose that God's given you work for. That's not what God's like allowed you to have a toil for. That's not what he's given you work for. Just so you can keep up with the neighbors and so you can have a status symbol of whatever you've attained with your money. It's a vanity. It's a chasing after the wind. You're never going to have enough. There's always going to be somebody that has more. I mean, Bill Gates can probably look across and go, well, there's like two or three people more wealthy than me. I need to catch up with them. I mean, it's always there. It's never going to end. It's a vanity. It's a striving after the wind. But the way forward in verse 5 isn't laziness either. So the fool folds his hands, right? So just lays it. Well, I guess I just don't need to do anything then and not work. Well, that's not the answer either. Not to fold your hands because then you end up eating your own flesh. Like you're eating the fruit of your labor. You folded your hands and now you have nothing. Better is quietness and rest than laboring to the end. That's the principle in verse 6. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and striving after the wind. So working excessively is a vanity. So does anyone else need to hear that in this room? Working excessively is a vanity. Better is one handful with quietness than two full of toil and striving after the wind. So then we have this scenario in verse 8. There's someone who has no one else and is laboring away, working excessively. So when it says they have no son or brother, what they're saying is they're not working, especially in that culture, right? Your inheritance was huge because your family would give you money in the form of land that you would farm and that would give you business for your life. So here's a person who has nobody that's going to inherit anything from him in verse 8, and laboring away, working excessively, and working in such a way that they never have enough, and never opening up their life to be generous to others. And Solomon says, this is a vanity and an unhappy business. So what are we being called to here? What's the better way forward? Well, the better way forward is not to work and live out of envy. Not to work and live just burning our wheels for no purpose. We're to enjoy our work with quietness. Taking our rest, taking our vacation, and opening up our lives to be generous to others. You know, that's thrown in there in verse 8. For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure, never satisfied with riches? You know, so there's a way that we're meant to enjoy life together. We're generous with one another, with quietness. One hand with quietness is better than two full of toil, working excessively. So you need to take advantage of vacation when you get it. You need to take advantage of time off. You should work hard when it's time to work. And then you should be able to unwind. So this is a hard word to listen to. Again, because a lot of times envy is driving that, right? Well, if I just had more money, then I could do this and I could do this. And, you know, the other people are doing this. Well, I need this too. You know, so he's saying there's a better way forward. One hand with quietness is better than two full of toil and excessive work. So speaking of having no heir, we continue into verses 9 through 12, which he's just said, having no heir with excessive work is stupid, basically. And then in verses 9 to 12, there's a call to not be a loner. So there are times when we'd rather just be alone, and we need to be reminded what this passage says. Look at verse 9. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. Again, we're still talking about toil here. We're not talking about marriage. So this verse is a lot of times read at weddings or put on your wall to like talk about the life you have together. It's great. As long as we're talking about the life work that you guys have together as a couple. It's about toil. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. If they fall, one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him who's alone when he falls and doesn't have another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they can keep warm, but how can one keep warm alone? And although a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. So the point here is that two are better than one. There's a better reward for a team working together towards something. If one falls down and you got someone else there, someone can pick you up. If you fall into a pit, for instance, which I guess this happened all over the medieval world, they'd try to trap you, or you'd have a pit there to trap a wild animal or something. And if you fall into that and no one's with you, you're at the mercy of the wild animals and whoever might come along someday to pull you out of that pit. But what if you're traveling together? It just makes common sense, right? That's the point. Or you might think, well, what if you're traveling and you're forced to camp all alone? So again, we think like, what's the big deal? Just check into the Motel 6 and you can keep warm. You got a blanket. You don't need two people. But that's not how things worked in the medieval world. Remember Jacob just freezing to death, laying there under heaven when the stairway vision came, just all alone, you know, and it's, well, you usually travel together and you keep each other warm. It just was part of the world. Camping alone, it was difficult to warm up. It's more difficult to warm up than when you're with others. Again, if you're in a fight with someone one-to-one, it might not go well, but if you have two, it changes everything. So the point is, you need others in the work that you've been called to enjoy. We weren't made to live this life all alone, going about our own business, and like living like Miss Independent, you know, just running around and doing our thing, doing our own thing. No, it's meant to be together. We're to be about this work together. So that's the better way of the toil, right? You know, rather than going at it all alone, you could rope in others and it'd be a better work. That's the wisdom for living. And then the final word, which I mean, it's just amazing. This is written like, you know, 2,500 years ago. There's a word about when political powers go awry. That's how chapter 4 ends. So let me read the verses and listen to what's going on here. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's palace. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this is striving, or vanity and a striving after the wind. So this better, there's another better here beginning at verse 13. It gets at this poor wise youth being preferable to an old foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. In other words, this king had forgotten where he came from. He was a classic rags to riches story. He had been in rags, been in prison, and God had raised him up to be the king. Okay? So all the living people moving about under the sun, along with this youth, who will one day be king, you know, living in the king's palace, living in the king's place. All these people are seeing the way this guy lives. There was no end to all the people he led. Yet those who come after him will not rejoice in his reign. And this is a vanity, a striving after the wind. This is something that doesn't have the purpose it should have been meant for. That's why it's a vanity, and it's a striving after the wind. It's elusive. You know, what is this? And I think it's just when political powers go awry. The point here is this king's rise to power was remarkable. God had brought him from this poor position, but in the end, no one rejoiced in him. So the application is for us in our toil, in our work that we're called to do with joy. We need to be aware of how that's affecting others around us, how we're toiling away. We can't forget how needy we are in this work, in the work that we've been given. I think that's why this one comes right after, you know, the two are better than one thing, that we need others. This king's not wanting to listen to anybody else's advice. He's headstrong. He has his own way figured out. He doesn't want to listen. And so there's so much wisdom for us in our toil then. Make sure that we're not oppressing people. Make sure we're leading with humility in the midst of our toil. See how much in our work we need others. And we shouldn't expect too much from our work, but we should enjoy it with quietness. Back to the previous context, right? The word on envy. We should enjoy it with quietness. God offers wisdom for a better way of living in the midst of our toil. He frees us from these things that we looked at. I mean, isn't this amazing? He frees us as we face oppression and we tend to tap out and say, well, I'm done. I'm not going to do the work that God's given me. I'm not going to enjoy that. Look at all this oppression going on. And he's saying, no, you be the one rejoicing in your work. You be the one counteracting all that oppression. You have joy in what God's given you. Or he frees us from envy by just saying, hey, rather than just burning your wheels to get more and more, what if you just kept one hand working with quietness rather than burning your wheels at both ends for toil? Or what if rather than just trying to go at it alone all the time, you just got the help of others? Two are better than one. Or what if in those leadership roles you're given in the midst of your toil, you exemplified joy? You made it such the case that any worker that works with you would want to do that enthusiastically because you're so full of joy. That's what chapter 4 is calling us to. So in chapter 3, God's fashioned all this time and done all this work to enable us to live in a way that fears him with joy, enjoying all these gifts that he's given us. And then in chapter 4, he just kind of turns that in some different aspects in our life. And now we have a different perspective on how we're to live. That's what he's up to in these two chapters. So this is so helpful for us. So in conclusion, we've seen two aspects of life under the sun that God fills with wisdom. God orders time that we may have joy in fearing him, and then he offers wisdom through a better way of living life, especially in the midst of our toil. So, I mean, you probably know this already, but God's always operated in time for our good. This is how God works. He operates in the midst of time. He doesn't stay above time and say, well, I can't get involved in their affairs. No, he jumps headlong into time. That's how Galatians 4 words it, right? In the fullness of time, God came, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who are under the law, that we might have adoption. So God's aim for you in time is always that you would relate to him. Just like chapter 3 said, he's relating to us in the midst of time that we might fear him and have joy in fearing him. He's always at work there. He's put eternity in our hearts. There's a longing you have in your heart for more, and it was put there by God. That's what this is saying for us. And he's going to execute perfect righteous judgment upon all those who oppose him, all this injustice in the world. He's going to execute a perfect and righteous judgment. And so the implication for us as we conclude is just run to him. Seek to fear him. Relate to him rightly. Bow your knee to his righteous rule and know the joy that he brings. So that's one strand of application. I think there's another strand. There's been many calls in this passage for doing our work with joy, seeing it for what it is. So don't overreach and just try to be like your neighbor. Don't seek two handfuls when one handful with quiet is all that God wants from you. You know, some of you are like even praying to God, God, give me energy for all this work that I have to do. And God's saying, you don't have to do all that work. I'm just calling you to this. One handful with quietness. So chill out, relax. Don't be lazy. So he said that too, right? But, you know, just don't burn your wheels. Lead others well. Be humble. So he's fashioned your times that you may seek him first. He's calling you to have joy in your toil and see it as his gift to you. And he's done all this that we might reverence him. And all this, I think, drives us. I think one issue of application that I want you to think about, which Paul recommended as a way of life too, is urging Christians to be content with what they have. Just this issue of contentment. So here's what Paul writes. Of course, there's great gain in godliness combined with contentment. If we have food and clothing, we'll be content with these. But those who want to be rich fall into temptation and are trapped by many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And in their eagerness to be rich, some have wandered away from the faith and have pierced themselves with many pains. That's 1 Timothy 6. And the author of Hebrews echoed this. Hebrews 13:5. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. That's a calling there. So today it might be the one reason that we're so displaced by the times that we live in and the work that we've been given is we're not content with what God's given us. God's given us an allotment and we're saying, yeah, but more please. Because I want this, or I need this, or, you know, they're offering overtime, which means I can make like triple the money. And yeah, it's going to mean that I don't get the time with those important relationships in my life. But, you know, it's all this stuff that God's just saying, be content. Now, I'm not saying you can't ever take the overtime or that there's not wisdom in that. You know, I get all that. Right? I'm just saying, but as a way of life, as a habit, I'm not even suggesting that there's not times in life that aren't busy, where you're going to be tired because there's a lot demanded of you in your toil. I'm just saying the calling here is to have joy in that. And I think the joy comes from being content, having a contentment in God. So let's embrace all that he's given us with contentment. Let's have joy in fearing him under the sun. And as we do, we'll be a people who glorify and enjoy him forever.